I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Live on air. Presented by Jer Sweeney.
Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company for another edition of Live on Air right here on Talk Radio Europe, the Irish programme. And we are, as we say here at the radio station, your voice in Spain. Coming up on this evening's programme, I have a mixed bag for you. Ireland is going to get its first technological university. I'll be talking to somebody who is involved in that and give us an idea as to what it is, when it's going to happen, and what ramifications there will be for students, for staff, and indeed for the country. You're also being asked, if you were walking down the street in Rome and you met Pope Francis, and as you know, Pope Francis is going to be visiting Ireland on the 25th and 26th of August. We'll be doing a lot more on that between now and then. But if Pope Francis said to you, as an Irish person, what would you like to say to me? What do you think you need to tell me about the Catholic Church in Ireland? Well, the Association of Catholic Priests in Ireland is asking that very question, and we'll be joined by one of them on the programme to tell us a little bit more about it. It's been a busy and it's been a messy week in relation to Brexit and Ireland particularly. And I'll be joined, as per usual, by Peter O'Dwyer, who is the senior business reporter with the Times Ireland edition, to talk to us about this past week in relation to Brexit and Ireland. There'll be some historical bits and sounds on the programme as well. And there'll be some Irish birthdays to tell you about coming up this week. If you would like to get in contact with the programme at any stage, if there's something happening in your community that you think the Irish people living in Spain or the people that are listening to the programme who would like to know about Ireland would be interested in, I would always like to hear from you. My name is Jer Sweeney, so the email address here is Jer, G-E-R, at talkradioeurope.com. G-E-R at talkradioeurope.com. Right, do you know what we'll do? We'll have a little piece of music before we get stuck into things, and then we'll take a look at some of the birthdays coming up this week on the programme. Do you remember the great trilogy by Roddy Doyle? Well, when they were all put into movies, they were fantastic, but the musical one was The Commitments. Let's take a track from Andrew Strong and the lads from The Commitments right now to get us underway on Live on Air on this Monday evening on Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.
Mustang Sally! Guess you better slow that Mustang down. Mustang Sally, my baby. Guess you better slow that Mustang down. You've been
That's Andrew Strong and the folks from The Commitments, and a song called Mustang Sally. Great song it is too, and what a great movie. What a great book. I read the three books, I've seen the three movies, and they're absolutely fantastic. So now, are we going to take a look at some birthdays? I think we should. And we have no birthdays to tell you about this week until Thursday, which is the 26th of July. Three birthdays of note of Irish people. George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, was born in Dublin in 1856. Danny LaRue, the drag queen, was born in Cork in 1927. And how many years ahead of his time was Danny LaRue? Mairead Ní Mhaoinigh, the singer, was born in Gweedore 56 years ago on Thursday. So she celebrates her birthday, born in 1962. We move on to Friday, which is the 27th of July, and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, the actor, was born in Dublin 41 years ago, 1977. Saturday is the 28th of July, and Eamon Ryan, the current leader of the Green Party in Ireland, was born in Dublin in 1963, so he will be celebrating his 55th birthday on Saturday. And finally, on Sunday of this coming week, Dermot Weld, the horse trainer, was born in 1948, 70 years old next Sunday. And Frank McGuinness, the playwright, born in Buncrana in County Donegal on the 29th of July back in 1953. So we say happy 65th birthday to Frank McGuinness in advance of all of that. So there we go. Now, coming up very shortly, we'll be telling you about Ireland's very first technological university. But first, let's have some music from the Dubliners. I don't know when we last featured the Dubliners, if at all. So here they are on the rocky road to Dublin. It's Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain, and it's the Irish programme, live on air.
Well, in the merry month of May, now from me home I started, left the girls and two and nearly broken hearted, saluted father dear, kissed me darling mother, drank a pint of beer, me grief and tears dismothered, enough to reap the corn and leaf, for I was born, got a stout MacLeod, the banished ghost and goblets, a brand new pair of brogues to rot the love of the bogs and frighten all the dogs on the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt ahead and turn them down the rocky road, turn all the ways to Dublin, make full aldi da. In Mullingar that night I rested limb so weary, started by daylight next morning late, and there he took a drop of the pure to keep me heart and shrink, and that's the paddy's cure. When there he's up for drinking, they hear the lassie smile, laughing all the while at me curious style, to touch a heart above him. They asked me was I hired and wages I required, till I was almost tired of the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt ahead and turn them down the rocky road, and all the way to Dublin, Macfalaliga. In Dublin next arrived, I thought it such a pity to be so soon deprived of view of Dublin City. Then I took a stroll all among the quality bundle, it was stolen in a neat locality. Something crossed me mind when I looked behind, no bundle could I find upon me stick, a warrant inquiring after the rogue, said me cunnus brogue, it wasn't much in Bowick. On the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt ahead and turn and down the rocky road, and all the way to Dublin, Macfalaliga. From there I got away, me spirits never failing, landed on the quay just as the ship was sailing. Captain at me rowed, said that no room had he, when I jumped aboard a cab and flew for paddy, down among the pigs, did some hearty rigs and paid some hearty jigs. The water round me bubbling, when I fully head, I wished myself was dead, or better far instead. On the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Up to hell and turn down the rocky road, and all the ways to Dublin, like Fulaldida. The boys of Liverpool, well, when we say safely landed, called myself the fool, I could no longer stand it. Blood began to boil, temper I was new as empowered old Aaron's Isle. They began abusing harami, so well says I, me shillelagh, I look fly. Galway boys were by, and so I was a hobbling with the low hooray. The giant in the affray quickly cleared the way for the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road, and all the ways to Dublin, Macfalaldida.
What a great song, The Rocky Road to Dublin, from the Dubliners, from all of those years ago. Alrighty, we will be telling you shortly about the very first technological university to come to Ireland.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
A little piece last week caught my eye, which said that Ireland was to get its first ever technological university. And I wondered what that was and read the piece. It was all about something that was being launched in Ireland last Tuesday. But before we talk about that, I want to talk about the Technological Higher Education Association, which is very much the driving force behind this, along with the political will that exists in Ireland for that. The Technological Higher Education Association CEO is a man by the name of Dr. Joseph Ryan, who joins me on the phone right now. Now, Dr. Ryan, good evening and thank you for joining us today.
Good evening, Gerald. Lovely to talk with you.
And you as well. You've been having Spanish weather in Ireland, I'm told, for a long time.
We've been having marvellous weather. We have burnt grass here. It looks a little bit like southern Spain, yeah.
I saw it on the open, yeah. I know that the UK is having the very same weather. Anyway, we're here to talk about technological universities. But first, I know you are CEO of the Technological Higher Education Association. What is that, please?
It's an umbrella body, essentially, Ger. It was formed 18 months ago, and the idea was a new organization that brought together all of the Institutes of Technology in Ireland, of which there are 14. There had been a previous legacy body called Institutes of Technology Ireland, and that comprised 13 institutions, the exception being DIT, Dublin Institute of Technology, which is the largest.
Okay.
So by bringing those, to all of them together, we formed what was called NALTHEA.
Okay. And what do you do?
We essentially work on policy. We're a representative body. We're an advocacy body. We work very closely with the Higher Education Authority, which is the body which is formed by government to look after the system of higher education and the funding. And then we work very closely with the Department on policy for higher education.
When you say about funding, then, who would fund NALTHEA?
It's funded through the institutions themselves.
Right.
Now, we do get some additional support from the Higher Education Authority, with whom, as I say, we work fairly closely, but it's essentially the institutions pay for NALTHEA.
Ireland is set to get its first ever technological university. What is a technological university?
Within Europe, there are essentially what one might call traditional academic universities, and there's a whole family of institutions now which might be called universities of applied science. They are institutes of higher learning that are very much focused on the practical application of learning. So it's a slightly different flavor. It's the same depth of learning, but you might say that the scope is much more towards application, linking into industry, into business, into practical usage. So Ireland has set up its whole family of institutes of technology. As you know, they're in existence roughly 50 years. Some are much older, but generally 50 years. And again, the history would suggest that the establishment of that family of institutes of technology in the late 60s, early 70s has been one of the great contributors to the dynamism of the Irish economy since then.
Okay. Now, I grew up in Limerick in the 70s, and I remember NIHE, which was the National Institute for Higher Education. It went on to become University of Limerick, or UL. Are technologies, or technical institutions, institutes, are they looked at now as maybe NIHE was in those days?
Yeah, it's actually a very good analogy. You remember the work that people like Ed Walsh would have done around that. You would have had the NIHE down in Limerick. You would have had what's now DCU again up in Dublin. Mm-hmm. They would have started off with a very much applied focus,
right,
and they were formed into universities. And again, even if you look at traditional universities, there will be a difference in flavor between, people will know, Trinity College as opposed to, let's say, the University of Limerick. And University of Limerick has a very good record in placing its students in industry as part of their training. And the new technological universities would be very much of that flavor, but even perhaps more so.
What currently separates an IT, an institute of technology, from a university?
At the moment, if you talk about the traditional universities, it's very much the type of pedagogies that are employed there. If you were going into an institute of technology at the moment, you are likely to spend quite a deal of your program on placement.
Yeah.
So you'll be working with industry, etc. Just to give you a practical flavor, you have people coming in from industry, lecturing on the program. That linkage is very, very clear to the world of work, if you like, to the world of application. That's not to say a traditional university wouldn't do some of that, but it certainly would be more pronounced in the Institute of Technology. With a technological university, the difference between that and an institute is one essentially of scale.
Last Wednesday, which was the day after the launch of the what's now going to be called TU Dublin, Technological University Dublin, there was a piece on the Irish Times, and it asked the question, it was written by Carl O'Brien, does Ireland really need more universities? How would you answer that?
It's a question that has been asked. It's a question that's been asked, as you can understand, Ger, by the traditional universities, because what you're getting is you're getting more competition into the space. All of this comes from a national strategy which was launched in 2011. It set out a path for technological universities and indeed the need for them. We're looking in Ireland at quite a demographic growth that goes up to around 2028, 2030. Certainly the capacity of the existing institutions, whatever type of institution they might be, is not there at the moment to meet the demand that's going to come at us. So we, as a country, as a people, we have to put in place the type of infrastructure that's going to meet the need of students in the future. At the moment, we have the highest number of students going to third level education in the whole of Europe. We have about 63% of our age cohort heading into a higher education. Mm-hmm. That's only going to grow into the future, and there's going to be more of them. So therefore, we need a much more diversified type of higher education infrastructure to meet that demand. And what's happening in Ireland mirrors very much what's happening in the more advanced countries in Europe.
Okay. How many of the technological universities are we going to see based on the fact that you've got 14 technical institutes at the moment?
Well, as you can also tell, what's happening here is consolidation, Jared. Yeah. So from the 14, you're going to reduce that number down into a small number of much bigger players, and players will have a much bigger impact, you know, on a global stage as opposed to a national stage. At the moment, we have four consortia. What was announced last week, as you see, is the first one, which is three institutes in the Dublin area coming together to form one major technological university. There are three other consortia at the moment working towards this end, and it's not a given. They have to meet criteria. They have to face into an international panel to show that they meet the quality and they satisfy the criteria that's set down in legislation. But if they do make that, we'll end up with four technological universities and four independent institutes of technology remaining.
All right, there'll be four independent remaining. Okay.
Yes.
That's interesting. TU Dublin is the first of these, and that is going to be a merger between DIT, the Institutes of Technology in Tala, and Blanchardstown. And at the launch of it last week, the government said that this was very much part of the government's plan to drive regional economic growth and development under the plan that they released last year, and we're all excited about it, the Ireland Project 2040, to make Ireland the best education and training service in Europe by 2026. If that is the case, why was Dublin chosen to be the first technological university, and why wasn't one of the regional areas brought forward?
It's a very good question. It wasn't chosen. This is part of that strategy I mentioned going back to 2011.
Okay.
All of the institutes were invited to, and it is an invitation. There's no compulsion in this.
Okay.
You can go into it or not go into it as they see fit. So it's part of their strategy. So all four of those consortia that I mentioned are working on this, and that involves 10 institutes of technology at the moment. It just happens that the maturity of somewhere like Dublin Institute of Technology and the other two colleges there was such that they were advanced quicker, and they managed to advance quicker than their fellows. But also, it would be a case that Dublin also is seen as a region. And if you're looking at trying to build and sustain economic activity, that's as important in a place like Blanchardstown as Tala, as it is in, let's say, Sligo or Limerick, as you mentioned earlier on.
Okay. In preparation for this, then, what changes do the institutes of technology have to make in order to bring themselves, to elevate themselves to university status?
And that's where they're working very hard at the moment to meet those criteria. Now, the first criterion is the interesting one, is there must be a merger. No institute of technology on its own can seek to be a technological university, regardless of size.
And is there an explanation as for the reason to that?
Well, again, that would go back to the question of scale, go back to international competitiveness, etc. But the other criteria, and there are many of them, but they include things like the number of staff with higher level qualifications, doctorates, for instance.
Right.
It also includes the number of research students. It includes ratios of undergraduates to postgraduates, etc. It's quite a complex scenario, and it puts big stress demands on the institutions to reach this. Most are either there or very close to it, but unless they reach that particular threshold, there's no point in applying.
All right. Now, the funding for this, it's been quite an expensive exercise, and you mentioned a little earlier on that you were working closely with the Higher Education Association. They have invested a lot of money. Is that public money?
That's public monies that are going into this. Now, okay. The institutes would also be employing some private monies that obviously towards the build of capacity to reach this. Last week, there was an announcement of $4.4 million for Dublin Institute of Technology on their path. There are other monies to be dispersed, but they're all competitive. Okay. So institutes must show the path they're on. They must show the progress they're making, and that attracts money.
All right. As we call them, traditional universities would have a great way of funding or raising funds from past students and so on. Will the new universities, will they be in a position, will they be able to fundraise among their former students and stuff like the traditional universities do?
Well, that's part of the longer-term thinking around this. If you look at some of our most mature of the traditional universities, they are becoming increasingly less reliant on public fundings because they have that capacity to go and seek private funding. That wouldn't be the same for a smaller institute of technology. Mm. But as these new technological universities come on stream with greater scale, and the one, for instance, in Dublin has 28,000 students, so you're talking about the biggest institution in the state, and you can imagine the alumni that they have going back over many years. So therefore, you now start to get the capacity to go and seek more private investment.
All right. And listen, I know we've taken a lot of your time on this one, but just finally, I know that early next year is the proposed date for TU Dublin to come into existence. What's the overall time frame, or is there one?
That's what they're looking at now. It's under the legislation that was passed in March of this year. There is a day of designation. So there's a period of work now that has been announced before the day of designation, which we anticipate to be in January of next year. Mm-hmm. What will happen in the interim is that a leader for that new institution will be identified. They'll put in place, and the governing body will be put in place, etc. So you're looking at this, that students who actually enroll in the under our central applications office system this September in these three institutions will be in a merged institution within the year, and they ultimately will attract a degree from the new technological university.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds like a very exciting project. I can understand why the world of academia and the world of politics will be getting quite excited about it. And I hope that it works out well for everybody concerned. And thank you, for talking to us today.
Ger, it's been a real pleasure. This is all part of our build towards, as you said, the Project 2020 plan of the capacity of building Ireland. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you and your listeners today.
Thank you very much indeed. Dr. Joseph Ryan, who is the CEO of the Technological Higher Education Association.
Yes, I'll take you back again. You knew I would. For I go on loving you, that's understood. But it's the first time you've come back with tears in your eyes. Lately, someone's taught you how to cry. Someone had to teach you. I didn't have the heart to hurt you just like you've been hurting me. Someone had to teach you. It's time that you knew. Now maybe you'll be satisfied with me. Someone took your heart and rubbed it in the dirt, and that look on your face tells me you hurt. But you had this lesson coming for so very long. Our sins have a way of coming home. Someone had to teach you. I didn't have just like you've been hurting me. Someone had to teach you things it's time that you knew. Now maybe you'll be satisfied with me. Now maybe you'll be satisfied with me.
That's Dominic Kerwin and a great song called Someone Had to Teach You. See what I did there? Teach after the university. If you missed it, you missed it. Anyway, if you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email me at any time. It's Ger, G-E-R, at talkradioeurope.com. I'd like to hear from you. Let us know what you think and what you're thinking and where you're listening as well. Right, so let's take a very quick break. Coming up just after that, we'll talk to Peter O'Dwyer about Brexit and Ireland.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
It's been a busy week in relation to Brexit and Ireland. And just before we came on air, Peter O'Dwyer, who is the senior business reporter for the Times Ireland edition, was talking to me, and we were talking about the last couple of weeks. It seems that things are changing on a daily basis in relation to Brexit, not just Brexit itself, but in relation to Ireland. And Peter joins us on the phone. Peter, good evening and welcome.
Thanks, sir.
As we're talking, things might change again, but we'll see if we can keep up with this. We'll see if we can keep up. I suppose looking back at the week, there's a lot that we could talk about, but a lot probably has been said already. But just in terms of Ireland, can we look at the amendments that went through last week? And following on from that, there was some discussion about the backstop that was agreed last December, which is vitally important to the border between the Republic and the north of Ireland. So can you take us through that, please?
Sure, yeah. We won't bore your listeners with most of the amendments that were going through Parliament.
I think in fairness, Peter, when they hear the word Brexit, I think this starts salivating anyway, so I think we can chat away.
Absolutely. We'll give the people what they want.
Exactly.
There was just one really that was of major interest, and that was one in relation to the backstop, as you said. The ERG, which is the hardline kind of Brexiteer party that's headed by Jacob Rees-Mogg, tabled this amendment. And essentially, it was passed by the UK because they needed to keep these MPs on side. And the argument that stemmed afterwards was, did this amendment essentially make the backstop that Theresa May signed up to in December illegal to be enforced if we got that far? Would it be illegal for her to put it into practice in the UK? That obviously caused quite a bit of consternation. Then if we fast forward a couple of days, Theresa May actually came to Ireland and Northern Ireland and visited the border region, which was the first time that she had done so throughout Brexit. The feeling was that she was coming to reassure people that the border was important to her, that the backstop was important to her, and to kind of give a two fingers maybe to Boris Johnson, who in his resignation speech had said that the backstop had become far too important and really we shouldn't all be focusing on it. Rather than coming and giving assurance to anybody, Theresa May basically said that the backstop agreement was unworkable, unenforceable, and encouraged the EU to, quote, evolve their thinking. Now, it's important to remember that this was the backstop agreement that Theresa May herself signed up to in December.
Yeah.
And reiterated her support in March. So when you look back, maybe it was a little politically naive of Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney to describe that deal last December as bulletproof and cast iron. But you would have to have a certain degree of sympathy with them as well when our closest neighbour and apparent closest ally makes an agreement, commits it to paper and has it signed off by the head of that country. You would expect that they might just keep their word and that you could negotiate on that premise. But it seems like Theresa May is intent on reneging on that commitment and that there are now going to be further talks on what a backstop will look like between the EU and the UK this week, which really just sets us back further. So all of which is to say that we are getting ever closer, inching ever closer to a no-deal scenario, I think.
That's exactly how it looks. Now, a question for you. The cast-iron guarantee, as we'll say, that we were given back in December, that Theresa May signed herself and her government up to, was accepted by Ireland and by the EU, which is one of the same, really. If she reneges on it, what support can we expect from the EU in relation to this?
I think the EU support is steadfast. I think it's steadfast anyway, but I think it would be particularly so if the little that has been agreed upon is now reneged upon. So we have the backstop apparently being reneged upon last week, and we saw just yesterday in the Daily Telegraph in the UK that Dominic Raab, the new Brexit secretary, has said that the divorce bill that was also agreed, $39 billion that the UK agreed to pay for its prior commitments and obligations, he has now said that that won't be paid unless there's a trade deal. So the two things, perhaps, that we got agreed last year now seem to be off the table again from the UK's point of view. So I think it's fair to say that that would be making the blood of the likes of Michel Barnier, Leo Varadkar, Simon Coveney, and everybody and anybody else in the EU boil, and perhaps not be particularly amenable to helping the UK out of a bind. So I think we can count on their support.
Is it my opinion, sorry, is it my imagination, or has the line from the British been, since the white paper was published, which is less than 2 weeks, been, lads, we know what we're doing now and the EU needs to catch up? Is there a little bit of that going on?
There is. I think there's a little bit of, if we can say it enough times, we can will it into existence. Yeah, because we've gotten so far with such little progress, and there's so few options remaining to Theresa May that I think she has now settled on this customs, on this Chequers plan. The plan, as you say, in just 2 weeks, has been roundly criticised by so many MPs, so many of her own party. It has been guardedly welcomed by the EU, but they also still have huge issues with it. And there was also yesterday in the Sunday Times in the UK a wide-ranging poll, but one of the findings was that I think it was just 11% of the UK public were in favour of the Chequers plan. So essentially, if while the plan was the best that the EU had seen out of her, they weren't delighted with it. Nobody in Parliament seems to be delighted with it, and the UK aren't delighted. The UK population and public aren't delighted with it. So I think she's just trying to bunker down and, as I say, keep repeating, this is now the ball in the EU's court and that they need to come up with a few solutions for her.
A no-deal Brexit would inevitably, I believe, lead to a hard border between the South and the North in Ireland. We saw last week that Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, said that if that was the case, at least 1,000 new personnel would be required to be recruited for the customs. We had the Gardaí and Garda Síochána a number of months ago saying that they have no strategy in place for additional personnel, and we know that the Gardaí are under pressure numbers wise anyway. If there's a hard border, it's going to make things more difficult. So with things changing so much, is it putting Irish business and business groups in a position where they just don't know what to plan for or how to plan for this?
I think that's absolutely true. And it's difficult for the likes of you and I to keep up with it just so we can have a chat once a week. You can imagine how difficult it is for businesses and business groups to keep up with it. As you mentioned, Varadkar did announce last week that there would be 1,000 new customs and veterinary officials hired for the Irish ports and airports to deal with the fallout of Brexit, which, if you were to just look at that as, hooray, there's 1,000 new jobs going to be created, then that's one good piece of news. But on the flip side, we had the IMF last week coming out with a new report looking at the impact of Brexit, and they suggested that a hard Brexit would cost Ireland 4% of GDP permanently, which, now, these numbers can be a little hard to actually put into terms that I suppose everybody can understand, but that would work out at an equivalent of maybe 30,000 to 40,000 jobs lost, according to Pascal Donoghue. So on the one hand, you've got 1,000 new people being employed, but on the other hand, you could have as many as 40,000 losing losses. Their jobs due to businesses going bust and just a reduction in trade. So that's a stark, and actually it's interesting, if any of your listeners had the time to go dig it out, IMF released a bar chart with this, and it was just striking. Obviously, we know that Ireland is by far the most exposed to a hard Brexit of all the EU countries, but the bar chart really put it starkly. You just had two twin towers of the UK and Ireland side by side, almost equal in terms of the impact. Wow. And then the next, the third place where it was the Dutch, and you could barely see them from on top of the Irish pole. It was just the difference between how exposed we are and how exposed every other country in the EU is incredibly huge. So in a way, it's surprising that the rest of the EU member states are as engaged with this as they still are, given that the impact to them will be minimal, but the impact to us will be very, very substantial, it looks like.
All right. Okie dokie. Well, if anything happens or happened in the last 10 minutes or happens in the next few hours, can I just say to listeners that I will be joining Giles Brown and his team, his panel on Viewpoint tomorrow morning here on TRE. And I'm sure that we haven't heard the last of Brexit and Ireland. In the meantime, Peter, I hope you have a good week. Thank you for joining us today. I'm sure it's going to be as busy a week next week as it was in the past couple of weeks. And we look forward to chatting to you next Monday.
Great. Thanks, sir.
That's Peter O'Dwyer, who is the senior business reporter with the Times Ireland Edition, talking to us about Ireland and Brexit.
Somewhere north of the border, that's where I want to be. Somewhere north of the border, my sweet Conchita and me, where we'll be happy together in the land of liberty. Somewhere north of the border, you and me. Somewhere beyond the horizon, over the Rio Grande, that's where my sun is rising, over Wonderland, where we'll get a job in a drugstore, or maybe a factory. Somewhere north of the border, we'll be free. And we can find a little place all of our own, where we can close our door when the daily work is done. We can hold our heads up high, and we can watch the world go by, and never have to bow to anyone. Somewhere north of the border, it's always in my mind. Somewhere north of the border, we're gonna leave the past behind. I don't care how long it takes me, how many dollars I must pay. Somewhere north of the border, we'll be free.
Live on Air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
As you probably are aware, Pope Francis will be visiting Ireland on the 25th and 26th of August. And there's been a lot of talk as to who he's going to see, what's going to be said to him, what he's going to say to other people. And the Association of Catholic Priests recently came up with a very novel idea where they're asking people at various meetings throughout the country to tell them what they would like to say to Pope Francis. And joining me on the phone right now is Father Brendan Hoban from the Association of Catholic Priests. Father. Brendan, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
It's a big event, Pope Francis coming to Ireland, and everybody is looking forward to it. I know I've been watching the news. There's been a little bit of controversy, but it's a big event, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's historic, I suppose, and for this generation, it's 40 years, really, effectively, since the last Pope was here, Pope John Paul II, and that was a huge event. Ireland has changed a great deal, as we know, in the 3 to 4 decades since then. But it's still a historic event, and I suppose the personality of Pope Francis is such that I think he's going to take the place by storm. So we're all very much looking forward to it.
Indeed. And speaking of a changed Ireland, I suppose Ireland's opinion towards the church as an institution has changed as well. And when Pope Francis comes to Ireland, he will be representing that institution. And where did the idea come from within the Association of Catholic Priests to ask people what they would like to say to the Pope?
Well, it came, I suppose, from our own frustration at not being able to sort of communicate with our bishops in the way we would like to communicate, or have a conversation with them about the many issues facing the Church in Ireland. So we decided, really, because it wasn't possible for us to talk to Pope Francis, we decided that why not open our association, in a sense, to the public and say, you know, we are worried about the Catholic Church in Ireland. By any estimation, there are a whole number of sort of situations and statistics that would indicate that we're in huge crisis in the Church in Ireland. And, people have very strong opinions one way or another about it. So we said, why not have a series of regional meetings all around Ireland, ask people what they thought. And I suppose what we're really saying to people is, you know, before you come to the meeting, think first of all about the fact that you might, if you happen to bump into Pope Francis, we'd say, on a street in Rome, and he said to you, I'm coming to Ireland next month, what are the 5 things that we should do in the Irish Church? What are the 5 things you want me to say? So basically, that's what we're doing. We've had already have meetings in Cork and in Tuam and in Dublin. We have another one coming up in a week's time in Cavan. And basically, what we're saying to people at the meeting is, tell us what you would say to Pope Francis if you happened to meet him. And at the end of the meeting, what we're going to do is we're going to just hand out a sheet of paper and say, in order of priority, put down the 5 things you would say to Pope Francis. They will form the basis of a report which we'll give to the Papal Nuncio and which we're hoping will be sent to Rome. Even if not sent to Rome, it'll be in the papers and people generally will know what exactly we're saying and what the people are saying. It'll be a small group, but we're also opening on our ACP website, asking people also to contribute. So the numbers will be fairly sizable, and we hope that we get a little bit of attention about it.
And what sort of feedback have you been getting to date?
Well, we've been getting sort of predictable enough stuff. For example, as everybody knows, in Ireland, there's a huge crisis in vocations. Parishes are closing. I'm retiring myself in a week's time. Oh. And the last resident priest in this parish, I'm not being replaced by a resident priest, after 800 years of unbroken service by a resident priest. That's, in a sense, an example of what's happening and what's going to happen progressively more and more around the country. And that has been a huge focus of attention. Also, I think the idea that the people, this is coming from the people particularly, not from the priests, saying, look, the world that priests inhabit, the world where bishops are embedded into, this clericalist world is really out of touch with the concerns and the implications of our lives as Christian people and as Catholics today. And that there's a huge gulf between what bishops are saying and what priests are thinking on the one hand, and where people are actually living in the day-to-day ordinary lives that they live. That would be another one. Another one would be fierce worries about young people who have effectively disappeared out of our churches. What can be done about it? Will the faith die in the next generation because there's no one to replicate it or to hand it on? So it's these particular issues, and there may be very sort of theological issues about hoping that Francis will sort of continue with the reforms that he was mandated by the cardinals at the conclave that elected him, the reforms of the Second Vatican Council, to go back to that. And fears people have and worries people have that there is no indication that the Irish Church is taking on board that reform that Francis is anxious to see in the Church.
You said that this information will be given to the Papal Nuncio, and it is hoped, as you said, that it will make its way to the Pope. Do you think it will?
We're not sure. And there are at the meetings, there were grave reservations when we suggested this. Some people began to laugh and so on, because the history of our association, even though we represent a third of Irish priests, the history of our association is we have asked time and again to meet the papal nuncio. He wouldn't meet us. Okay. We've asked time and time again for the bishops to have a realistic and practical engagement, ongoing engagement with us. They're not particularly interested in that either. So we're regarded as sort of raving sort of radicals, when in effect what we're saying is what Pope Francis is saying. We said it before he came, because we were founded, before he was elected. But what we have found to our delight is that he's now saying all of the things, or most of the things certainly, that we are saying.
Okay.
And, you know, from that point of view, from our point of view, we haven't got the official church in Ireland backing us, but we believe that the people are very much on our side, and there are things that need to be said, and that's why we're having our meetings.
Is there a huge gulf between the bishops and the priests on the ground? Is there a huge lack of communication and understanding between the bishops and the priests?
Well, I think there is. I think both of us, in a sense, are in the same camp, because the big worry now, really, and we're all aging. Like, I'm 70 years of age, and I'm retiring. And yet, the average age of priests in Ireland is 70.
Right.
So, like, in a few years' time, in the Killala Diocese, for example, which is North Mayo and West Sligo, that I'm from, in our diocese, in 15 years' time, we're going to have 5 priests for 22 parishes. Now, that reality is only beginning to dawn. And now priests who are aging and who are getting ill and who would like to retire and so on and so forth are now sort of pressed into service to keep going until they actually drop. And, you know, the priests are unhappy with this. The people are unhappy with it, because there are no people coming up after us. We're only about 30 students, I think, in Maynooth at the moment. Maynooth is becoming the last seminary in Ireland. Mm-hmm. All the other seminaries have closed. So, the bishops, we believe, are at an extraordinary level of denial about what's going to happen. And we have been saying, look, we need to ordain women. We need to ordain women as deacons. We need to ordain married men. We need to decouple celibacy from priesthood. And this is going to happen. We know it's going to happen, because it has to happen. There is no plan B. And basically, these are the issues and these are the ideas that are coming through in our meetings. The decisions need to be made, or the church in Ireland is simply just going to fold up.
All right. I know you're under pressure, so I'm not going to delay you. If somebody would like to contribute to your campaign, they can log on to your website, I presume?
Absolutely. The Association of Catholic Priests, and they'll find us there.
Okay. associationofcatholicpriests.ie. And one final question. I wish you well in your retirement, but I know a lot of priests in Ireland, when they retire, they actually stay semi-working because they have to. Will you be in that position, or can you relax?
Well, I hope to relax, and I hope to do some of the things that I would like to do and that I haven't had time to do after 45 years of service.
Wow, long time.
In the priesthood in this diocese. But hopefully I'll get a chance to maybe help out in different ways. But I think part of our difficulty is that if the priests who are at retirement age were prepared to say, no, we want to retire, we don't want to sort of work until we drop, maybe the decisions will be made faster. So in a sense, you know, by retiring, I think it hastens the inevitable decisions that are going to be made.
All right. It's a wonderful idea from the Association of Catholic Priests. I hope it goes well for you. I hope the Pope Francis actually gets to see and hear what the people are thinking in Ireland. And I wish you well in your retirement once again, and hope it's a long and happy one.
Thanks very much,
Father Brendan Hoban from the Association of Catholic Priests in Ireland. There we go, that is Gina, and that's a great song called Why Did You Wait to Tell Me? That's my lot for today. I do hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have presenting it to you, and I'll be back with you again next Monday. As always, thank you very much indeed to my colleagues here at Talk Radio Europe for continuing to promote the program throughout the week and to speak very highly and nicely of it as well on air. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you as well to our cultural correspondent who is working with me, as I told you last week. Jose Antonio Sierra has been in touch with a lot of people in relation to the programme, and we're trying together to forge better links culturally between Ireland and Spain. Antonio has a lot of connections in both Spain and in Ireland, and I'm working on the Irish side of it, and indeed some of the Spanish side as well, and trying to make things happen. So if you are receiving this program, compliments of Antonio, I do hope you've enjoyed it, and please feel free to let either Jose Antonio or myself know exactly what you think of it. Alrighty, until next week, from me, Ger Sweeney, thank you very much for your company. Look after yourselves and each other for the coming week. I hope it's a good one, and we see you next Monday, just after the news at 6, right here on Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.